Welcome back to Bubble Trouble. I'm the independent analyst Richard Kramer, and I'm joined by the economist and author Will Page. Today, we welcome back Fergal Sharkey, who visited Bubble Trouble last summer and dropped a water bomb on our privatized utilities. He's fought the noble fight to expose Thames Water as profiteering polluters, and 9 months later, we have a massive credit bubble bursting, dumping toxic sewage in both debt-laden shell companies and the real shit floating in our rivers and seas. While private equity owners took out 78 billion pounds of dividends since privatization kicked in. A warning, this conversation should make everyone angry, whether you draw a drink, go for a wild swim, or just watch your rising water bill. We're asking how this utility privatization bubble caused so much trouble, revisit my prediction that the Thames Water bondholders would get whacked, and ask what comes next. Back in a moment.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Now, Fergal, this is a first for us in that it's the first time we've ever had a repeat guest. We've never done this before.
Right.
We have a rule on our show, which is for our audience's benefit, America, Britain, Australia, around the world, assume no prior knowledge. But they can listen to the earlier show, but they're going to listen to this one.
Fine.
So just very quickly, in that succinct style you have, bring us up to the 20-yard line on yourself, how we can follow your work, and what we're actually going to be tearing into here.
Well, I have a terrible passion that I've had for over 50 years of standing around in the middle of rivers, waving bits of high-tech carbon fibre around my head in a futile attempt to persuade completely indignant, untrustworthy trout and salmon to hang on to the end of my fly line. And I've spent decades of my life fly fishing. And that puts me in on next to close up to rivers and the environment. So I come at it from a clearly very hands-on experience. My introduction into what we're going to get around to talking about came, I was made chairman of the oldest fly fishing club in the United Kingdom, called the Elmwell Magna Fishery. We, for 186 years now, looked after 2.5 miles of chalk stream in Hertfordshire. And about 5, 6 or 7 years ago, we found ourselves taking the environment regulator to the High Court here in the UK because we felt they were not delivering on the job that they were set up to do. Now, the truth is, once they realised that we were serious and we were all heading up into the High Court, we then managed to resolve the situation quite quickly. But that kind of just made me curious. Simply because there's only 60 members of the Elmwell Magna.
Right.
And I became fascinated why 60 men and women of a certain age who just want to go fishing had to go to the trouble of basically taking the environment regulator in the UK to the High Court simply to get them to do their job. And that gave me an itch. Stupidly, naively, foolishly, I scratched that itch. And as you guys have discovered, every time you scratch that itch, you just end up with a bigger itch. And here we now are, where we're looking down the gun barrel of England is the only nation on earth that has a 100% utterly privatized water industry. And it's becoming increasingly apparent by the second. In terms of this particular privatisation, it has completely and utterly failed.
Right. So, I mean, this is a thing which is At the moment, as we record this podcast, I want the audience to appreciate I'm actually quite upbeat. I'm catching up with our dear old friend, Fergal Sharkey. We're in the wonderful Apple Platoon Studios, but I know at the end of the next 40 minutes, I'm going to have to lie down on the floor in a dark room and take paracetamol with a migraine that's about to hit. Last summer, you literally dropped a ticking time bomb on our podcast,
yeah,
raising the red flag on Thames Water and its ugly sisters. How much time is left to tick? Because I think what we're about to uncover in the next 40 minutes is this bomb is ready to go off.
This bomb actually has been ready to go off since last summer. As an update on the figures that you touched upon briefly, the latest estimate by the FT a week ago, those water companies have now taken £80 billion worth of value in cash out of those companies. And also now saddled them with £60 billion worth of debt.
Before I met you when I moved to London in 2006, I was an economist back in Edinburgh. And I think the GDP of the Scottish economy was £80 billion.
Oh, yeah, this is so we're talking just shocking, give context shocking amounts
on the size of carpetbagging that's been going on.
There's a number of things that kind of triggered it all. At one end of the scale, we have water companies. The only asset they have is actually the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And they've all been allowed to basically securitise the infrastructure. Now, they embraced that idea with remarkable enthusiasm to the extent that there are some of them now have even gone so far as to securitise the maintenance budget that's spent on maintaining the infrastructure. Some of them have even tried to securitise the interest payments on the original debt. And all of it just creating this utterly fictitious bubble
arbitrage
sitting in the balance sheet that is just made up nonsense. There's also, there was a change in the law about 20 years ago where the original licenses that water companies were issued, because they all have an operating license issued by the English government. And about 20 years ago, the law was changed where those licenses are now completely no time limit to them. They're indefinite. And the only way that the license can be broken is if the government give the water company 25 years notice that they're going to revoke the license. So you now have a situation where you've got a lot of quite aggressive, competitive fund managers, hedge funds owning these water companies, thinking, good God, I've got 25 years worth of profit. I can just load up enough debt that equates to about 20 years worth of profit, pay the lot of it through to myself as a massive dividend, and then get the double whammy where I can now start charging this water company interest payments on the debt that I just put on its balance sheet that I've already paid through to myself as a massive dividend.
Gangsters, absolute gangsters. Now, I want to walk before we run here, and I'm conscious a lot of people will listen to a podcast whilst reading, and they may not have heard our first episode with you last summer. Who are the journalists in the broadsheet newspapers and on TV that people should be following as this story develops?
The ones that started it all in terms of really mainstream coverage, you are back to the FT and Jill Pilmer.
Friend of the show, and Jill's
and
fantastic.
Jonathan Ford and stuff, and they began laying the foundations on this 10 years ago, if not even more. They were waving a massive white flag going...
Does Thames Water's comms team have a sort of speed dial?
I suspect they have, but here's the thing. That is now, we've got to the point where this is just so broken into the mainstream. Even the breakfast television shows now are covering this on a daily basis.
Yes.
Every single day, there's now at least three or four stories running in the national media. Radio, TV, it just is now mainstream coverage.
And then before handing you over to Richard where he's going to go deep, let's just tackle this nationalisation question. In England it's privatised, but that's not the case for the rest of the UK.
No. In Wales it effectively is a kind of a mutual for profit. But by the way, that's got its own issues because it happens to be actually the Welsh Water is the largest sewage dumper in the United Kingdom. In Scotland, it's still owned by the state.
Yep.
There's massive issues up there. And in Northern Ireland, in fact, today, the estimate is Northern Irish Water, again owned by the state, is now suggesting that last year they dumped about 20 million tonnes of sewage into the environment in Northern Ireland.
So for the advice of surfers, it's not on these aisles.
Oh, not in the least. Absolutely not in the
least. And just lastly, nationalisation, this will come across again during our conversation here, but what is Fergal's political perspective on nationalisation? If I think about Railtrack, I think the government had to pay around $500 million in dividends to get Network Rail onto the balance sheet and incur $30 billion in debt. That doesn't sound like a good trade for the public purse, but it did allow us to run the railways safely, and we haven't had a Ladbroke Grove since.
Well, here's the thing, and again, the article was written by a man called Jonathan Portes, who you may know. Jonathan, at the time, was a young official in the Treasury. The water industry was the last of that long line of privatisations back in the mid-1980s. And things like rail and BT and everything else went on, and mobile phone systems, and it raised huge, colossal amounts of money for the Chancellor of the Exchequer and for the Treasury here in the UK. The water companies were the last one. And according to Jonathan, the desire and ambition became to actually just end up with a massive oversubscribed flotation. And that's exactly what happened. So from day one, as it turned out, and I can't quite remember the figure, but we as the taxpayer, owners of the water companies at that point, got completely shortchanged the very day of the initial float, because the share price just exploded 10 minutes after the initial offering.
As Richard always says, privatise the gains and socialise the losses.
Totally. And the water companies from day one completely gamed the system. Quite quickly after the initial flotation, the fund managers and the venture capitalists started moving in, because then they quickly realised, oh, good God, we can actually securitise all kinds of things against the value of the infrastructure. And the biggest one of all, it's out there right now, that began the problem we're going to get round to discussing, was when Macquarie acquired Thames Water in 2006. And Macquarie designed the blueprint on how to extract all of that value out of that company. And it's a model that everybody else, to some extent or other, has simply followed.
Last point for our audience, our 100th episode, we had Andy Fastow from Enron, the former CFO of Enron. It feels like Macquarie, Richard, could be a modern-day Enron in terms of what they've got away with here. Over to you, sir.
Well, Fergal, there's three big topics I want to revisit from our last podcast, having just listened to it. The first one, which is just galling, and we keep coming back to it in a bubble trouble, is regulatory capture. Okay. All through this period of privatization, there was supposed to be a hall monitor, a sort of the adult in the room, someone who would say to these companies, hang on a second, you're not fulfilling your obligations. You're dumping too much sewage. You're not investing enough in infrastructure. You're overloading the companies with debt. And yet, time and again, that process failed. Is there any hope that the regulator will be the tiger that changes stripes, that becomes someone who holds the companies to account? Because that's the first step, even before we talk about nationalization. Yeah. Someone has to watch what's going on here and ensure compliance.
Yeah. Well, here in the UK, or in England rather, we have actually two regulators. So one wasn't good enough, because you got to, if you're going to have one mess up, well, you can have two that can mess up. So the Environment Agency was supposed to ensure that the activities of these companies were not in any way damaging the environment. Well, it turns out we now know last year, water companies spent 3.6 million hours dumping sewage into rivers and streams. Every single river in England is polluted, and one of the biggest sources of that pollution is the water industry. So the environmental bit, utter failure. The economic regulator is the one that was supposed to ensure. Exactly, as you described.
Office of Water.
Office of Water.
One T away from Ofwat.
And believe me, that one T's not enough. They developed, from what I can see, the system of regulation that they would refer to as reputational regulation. That they genuinely thought that if they wagged a finger and named and shamed these companies in public, that it had been some way motivate and drive these companies to do the right thing and behave and comply with the law and do what was expected of them. As I have recently described to someone, and I might be jumping ahead slightly, so forgive me, as we now know, the Chinese government owns about 8-9% of Thames Water. Thames Water's parent company has just defaulted on a £190 million bond that was supposed to be repaid. Two of the biggest creditors of that bond are two of the Chinese state banks. There is a debt for equity swap involved in the original deal. So you now have a situation where directly and indirectly, the Chinese government is potentially about to become the largest shareholder of the largest water company in the whole of East Western Europe. And you just sit there going, I presume the regulator was paying attention, because we've actually just about to hand control, cede control to the Chinese government of a monopoly providing drinking water to 15 million people living in the Great
Firkle. And as you pointed out in the last podcast, brilliantly, of course, the chief executive of Ofwat ended up at Thames Water.
Acting chief executive of Thames Water.
Right.
And indeed, I still have it. The original operating license granted to Thames Water is signed by Catherine Ross, then chief executive of Ofwat, the regulator.
The chicken soup club.
It's now, yes. And has been until quite recently, acting chief executive
musical
of Thames
chairs.
Water.
Yeah. Okay, second, we now look at the accounts of this business, Thames Water.
Yep.
And about 30% of the cost that Thames Water is bearing now
servicing debt.
Is servicing the debt.
Yeah.
Okay, we get that. And to some degree, they have to incur debt because they need it to invest.
Yeah.
But isn't the government the lowest cost borrower out there? Aren't they the one who should be assuming that debt on behalf of all the taxpayers that they want to protect?
Well, you see, here's the thing. It is, and I'm using this very loosely. You buy a company for, let's say, 2.9 billion quid. You then put 2.9 billion pounds worth of debt on the balance sheet of the company, issued of a bond out of a holding company in the Cayman Islands.
Right.
And you then, in this country, get to charge, I think the calculation at the time was somewhere between 16 to 20% a year
interest. Right.
And in this country, in the UK, that kind of intercompany loan is tax-free.
Indeed.
So you've actually found a very efficient way.
Yeah.
You get a double bonus.
But it wouldn't be a problem, correct me if I'm wrong, if they took that $2.9 billion they raised in debt and plowed it into the infrastructure.
And
but instead, it scarpered out of the country through these seven layers of shell company and into the pockets of the shareholders.
We now have a situation where Thames Water, currently its parent company is carrying about £16 billion worth of debt.
Kemble Water is effectively bankrupt.
And as it turns out, and I've had somebody to look into this over the last couple of days, as best we can calculate right now, every single year that Thames Water has been in operation, the shareholders have taken out more money than they ever invested and put into the company. So the thing was just a massive cash cow.
Right, it was being milked.
And as a general rule of thumb, when a water company in this country goes, oh, we're investing X amount of money, the only money going into that company is being provided by the bill payers.
100%.
The shareholders are putting little, if anything, into it, and they're abstracting, well, as we now know, £80 billion worth of value.
Yep. And let me get to my third big point, which is the counter-argument you hear, which is, oh, well, if we want anyone to invest in the UK, we need to have the rule of law that protects investors. And how far
they haven't had a dividend in 7 years.
For protecting investors have looted the, you know, but when you catch the guy who's burgled your house, do you worry about the niceties of protecting his rights as you think about asking him for some of the stuff back?
Well, see, this is now the kind of level of scrutiny that they're now under, where Will's comment about, oh, we haven't paid any dividends in the last 7 years. Thames Water still tries to make this argument until you actually go and look at the accounts.
Yep.
And you'll find that there is actually, and I'm using their language, a dividend paid on an annual basis back upstream to one of the parent companies further up the thing.
Right. So, and whether you call it's a matter of semantics, whether you pay out a dividend, which is tax to capital gains tax, or you pay interest on debt, which you can write off against investment.
I've actually had this conversation with somebody quite senior in Thames Water. And I went, well, listen, here's my corporate experience. If you refer to it as a dividend in your annual accounts, and therefore the board has witnessed it, agreed it, and signed off on it, on the fact that it's a dividend payment, and the external auditors have noted it and agreed it and signed off on it as a dividend, it's probably a bloody dividend.
Yep.
And you can make all the semantic argument you want about the fact we've not paid any dividends.
Right.
Truth is, they have. The truth is, what actually blew the whole whistle was an awful lot of that debt. And I think I've seen figures between 65 to 85% of the bonds covering that debt were index linked. And last summer, as the interest rates and inflation rates started edging up, that drove up the interest payments. Now, water companies here in England have this 5-year fixed income cycle.
Right.
So they negotiate with the regulator. here's the next 5 years worth of business plan. This is what we think we want to charge our customers. So you end up with a fixed income for the next 5 years.
Right.
So you now have the situation where your quarterly interest payments on the £16 billion worth of debt is now going through the bloody roof because inflation's going up. You've got fixed income and you simply don't have the cash coming into the business to even properly service your bloody debt.
Right, which is why all of the righteous anger is focused on the fact that we're being told, having been delivered terrible service, woeful infrastructure, and having shit dumped in our rivers,
yep,
we're going to pay somewhere between 40 and 60% more in the next five-year cycle.
It's even worse than that, and afraid, because there's an awful lot of, and forgive my language, but I would refer to as arse covering going on as we speak.
Yeah, sure.
Ofwat, the regulator, has now written two letters to the water companies. One reminding them of their legal obligation in this country that they are supposed to, by law, build, operate, maintain a properly functioning sewage system, one that is capable of, and I am quoting, effectually dealing with the contents of those sewers. Mm-hmm. I.e., it doesn't matter what's in that sewage system. If it's in there, it's your problem. The law says you have to deal with it and dispose of it properly and within the rules and the regulations. The second letter, Ofwat doubled down by going, oh yeah, and by the way, since privatisation for the last 33 years, we have made sure that you secured all of the funding you needed to comply with that legal obligation. And that is something that your board certified to us on an annual basis. And you've done it for 33 years, that you have all of the resources and the systems, the strategies, the plan and the people to actually meet and deliver.
And if that turns out not to be true, what is the recourse?
Well, the first part is that what the regulator is saying is we've already paid them to do this job once.
Right.
And they've taken the money.
Right.
Now, it was clearly never spent. Now, the question then becomes, why on earth would anybody want to pay a second time for a service you didn't get the first time round? They are now in the background. Thames Water yesterday asked for a 46% increase in prices.
Yep.
Southern Water are asking in real terms for 70% bill increase over the
60.
Next 5 years.
Yep, yep.
It's just insane.
Yep.
And all of it, the reality of it, actually is back to simply servicing that level of debt that these companies are now carrying.
Saddled with.
That they're now saddled with. So here's the reality of the situation. I take a very brutal approach to the bond holders that are dealing with this. They're professional bond managers.
Yep.
You made a decision.
Right.
I've got two words, due and diligence.
Yep.
What bit of USS here bought, I think, about 10% of Thames Water in 2017.
And then it came back
2 years later and took another 10%.
Yep.
So what bit did you not understand what you were getting yourself into?
Yep.
Or was it just the allure of the history? These things were massive cash cows and they poured cash out of every orifice.
Yep.
Or as my good friend George Monbiot puts it, the only non-leaky pipe a water company ever built is the one between the bill payers' pockets and the shareholders' bank accounts.
And Will loves my comment I made in the last podcast about, well, there's only one solution, that the bondholders get whacked.
Yeah, they take a, so get
they
over
take
it.
A haircut.
Absolutely, tough luck.
And pulling time and a good time.
As it turns out, Thames Water's now beginning to contaminate the rest of the industry. People started shorting here in this country on Thames Water's bonds a week ago, down to less than 15p in the pound.
Yes, for the top level debt.
For Kemble. And in the last couple of days, Millennium and Arrow Street in North America have started shorting on one of the three listed water companies here in the UK, United Utilities. And I don't need to explain to you guys, we're now looking at the end game when you get the kind of prospectors moving in at that level and shorting listed companies. It's game over for the industry.
I want us to get to the end game and what happens next in part two. Will, do you want to close
out
part one?
I got a couple of questions. One thinking aloud, one on the topic of inflation as we hurtle towards a break. And I got a feeling this ticking time bomb will explode in part two of this show. But just thinking aloud, dumb kid in the classroom question.
Yeah.
You said that the water companies say to the government, here's my 5 to 6 year plan.
Yeah.
And if I think about privatised utilities, for our American audience, governments of all persuasion have gone headlong into privatisation in this country. I look at the rail service.
Yep.
Full disclosure, I had personal loss in the Hetfield train crash. This one matters to me.
Yep.
But the East Coast line between London and Edinburgh, I've lived on for the past 30 years of my life.
Yeah.
But I have seen it change hands.
Yeah.
It was LNER. It was Virgin. It has changed. There's been evidence of government saying, you're doing a crap job. I'm taking it off you and giving it to someone who can do a better job. Does that happen with privatised water companies, or do they get the job for life?
Is that too much lock-in? Because of this change in the operating licence back in 2003, they now hold those licences indefinitely.
So there's no credible threat from the government to say,
none.
You effed up, it's coming back under control.
And if the government want to revoke that licence, they have to give the company 25 years' notice.
And there's a game theory there. If there's no credible threat, it's a licence to print money for the utility. This is where it all falls apart on the credible threat to say, if privatisation doesn't work, it comes back over to the other side.
For me, there's kind of two layers to this, Will. One is there was this tacit political nod and wink that the regulator's job was to suppress and maintain low prices to the consumer.
Right.
That's not written down anywhere, but I've just always had this instinct sitting in the background was a lack of political oversight and this ambition, and you'll know this from your own days in government, that we do not want to be the government that's been saddled with a massive increase in water prices because people will just see it as an indirect form of taxation and we'll take the blame. The regulator then developed this completely barking mad system of reputational regulation, and the regulator clearly was simply not up to the job and was outmaneuvered, outstrategized every single step of the way by the companies and the owners of those companies. That's the brutal reality of it.
Last question before the break. I want to bring up the word inflation before we close out here, because inflation has embedded itself into the economy.
Yeah.
Just quickly give us a snapshot of what that does to the economics of providing water, but what that does to the politics of what's going to happen to water bills. We talk about prices for the consumer going up, but we have inflation. Does that make it a double whammy for the consumer?
Well, that's what triggered the whole thing for Thames Water, was the inflation creeping up here in the UK last year.
Right.
And that started pushing up interest rates. Most of the debt and the bonds they had were all index linked. So as soon as inflation starts kicking in, suddenly their debt and the level of financing needed to service the debt starts increasing exponentially, and they're on a fixed income. So there's no way you can actually just get a sales team into an office on a Monday morning going, right, get on the phones, we need to sell an extra 1,000 widgets a day. By Friday or we're in trouble. You're stuck until the next five-year pricing cycle with the regulator. You're on fixed income. You're then looking at the shareholders going, well, you're going to have to put the money in here. And that's exactly what has happened to Thames Water. The shareholders just went, we're not putting any more cash into this business. It's just sending good money after bad. We're done. And that's why Kemble's now defaulted on the bond that was due at the beginning of April.
Yep.
To use the American football analogy, Richard, we could talk about block and tackle, where you take out the quarterback's options. If the quarterback's Thames Water, they don't have any options left.
Well, let's go to the break, because we want to get back in the second half and talk about what comes next. How do we get out of this mess? We cannot simply expect that, do the same, carry on.
Yeah.
And the level of public anger, the state of our water infrastructure, this has now become a mainstream issue that...
In an election year,
there needs to be some solutions. So let's come back after the break and we'll see what clever ideas Fergal has for how we fix this leaky bucket of
the campaign to vote for Fergal for president starts now.
Don't go there.
Yeah. Back in a moment.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome back to Bubble Trouble with myself, Will Page, the independent analyst Richard Kramer, and our very special guest, like a boomerang, he has come back for more, Fergal Sharkey, where we are discussing and dismantling the ticking time bomb that is Thames Water and our privatised water companies, which have been polluting and profiteering our rivers for the past 20 plus years. Richard, go down that rabbit hole because we don't have much time left.
We really don't. And look, Fergal, I want to talk about the options of what is going to happen next, because obviously the vampiric banksters here will want to say it sets a terrible precedent to whack the bondholders. Of course it was caveat emptor, but you can't do that to us. How do we avoid a protracted legal battle over preemption rights by, frankly, litigious bastards like Elliot, who we see involved right now? The FT comments on Elliot taking a stake and being public about it were so instructive.
Yep.
Are they simply getting long and loud because they want to dump their stake because they realize time is up? Are they getting in and going to try to hold the government to ransom like they did in Argentina?
Well, they can try to, but I don't think they're going to succeed.
Okay.
And there's a number of reasons for it here. By way of background, there was a case that went all the way to the Supreme Court here in the UK last summer involving Northern Rock.
Oh, yeah.
Where, as you may remember, when Northern Rock got into difficulties and was effectively nationalised, the shareholders got nothing.
Yep.
On the simple basis that the share value of a company that's effectively bankrupt is nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So 10 years later, the highest court in the UK agreed with a simple idea that the share value of a company that's bankrupt is nothing. So the shareholders aren't getting a penny. So in case of Thames Water, well, guess what? Your company's fundamentally bankrupt, so you're not getting anything.
Mm.
In terms of the bondholders, I have absolutely no empathy for them in any way, shape or form. They should not see a penny of the public's money.
Right.
And here's the thing. Ultimately, and I appreciate people go, oh, well, nobody will want to invest. Really? Who doesn't want a piece of running and being involved in a state monopoly supplying drinking water to 15 million people in London. For me, the real issue is not so much the kind of ownership structure in the short term, the next few months, but the simple truth is, by my estimation, there's at least three or four of those companies are going to need restructuring and refinancing within the next few weeks and months. And I could quite happily extend that to eight, which is over half of the water companies in England.
Right.
Probably are going to need some kind of refinancing in the next 6 to 7 months. And all of that will be triggered by Thames Water going down. Water companies in this country cannot go into voluntary liquidation. If they do, there's a process triggered by the High Court called special administration.
Yes.
And it's, if you like, a kind of, I guess the Americans might refer to it as Chapter 11 or something.
Yep. Working it out.
Where you can put it in. And you can restructure it, and then government can then decide whether it's just going to take state control over it and hang on to it, or turn it into a mutual, or reprivatise it, or do any amount of things. There's a huge demand right here, right now, as you've indicated. 69% of the British voting public now think the water industry needs to be renationalised.
Yep.
That's going to be big pressure for any government to try and ignore in an election year.
Yeah, and something we mentioned last podcast is how that's evenly split between left and right.
Oh, yeah.
It's not just the Fabian socialists on the left hand or the hardcore free marketeers on the right.
Correct.
Everybody agrees that this is a case of market failure.
Yeah.
Now, that actually fascinatingly flips the script right the way back to Thatcherism, which you started out with in the last podcast, that somehow these privatized utilities are going to be run more efficiently. And my big question now is, within this industry, is there the management, the talent, the will, and the investment to make the fixes of our decrepit infrastructure that are needed? If the capital is made available by the government.
I have to say this, the quality of people I've met within the water industry, I have found shockingly poor. And I've said it in public now, so I'm happy to repeat it. Number of senior managers, we're talking chief executive level here. I admit my experience is the British music industry. I've spent all of my adult life working in it.
Which is highly dysfunctional, by the way. Highly dysfunctional.
Highly dysfunctional, but by the way,
so bent it
highly
straight.
Successful.
Yeah.
Brutally successful on a global world.
Absolutely.
None of those guys would ever survive until lunchtime on a Tuesday work in the British music industry. Mm. That level of incompetence would simply not be tolerated. They'd be long gone.
And also,
as my father would say, you wouldn't give them a job in a shoe shop.
Certainly wouldn't.
And at a system level, and this is something we had a podcast with Bill Radishel a couple of weeks ago talking about this, at a system level, you know, the government needs to start training hydrologists and water engineers.
Oh, sure.
They need to start recruiting the people to do the work. They need to start training the cadres of management that don't think it's okay to dump sewage and create a whole new ethos for these companies. But my question is that possible? Because I'm worried that talent base, that management will isn't there and hasn't, that's a muscle that's been let to atrophy for 30 years.
Well, here's the thing that's now become increasingly apparent, and I may have discussed it the last time we were here. We now know that there's been a lack of political oversight and engagement. We now know the regulatory system simply is not up to the job.
Not fit for purpose.
So that also is going to have to be completely restructured, re-engineered, abolished, replaced, rebuilt. And the industry itself is clearly due for a massive shake-up. The thing that I am pretty certain is now going to trigger it, and it's becoming increasingly apparent over the last few days and weeks, London is now on the cusp of running out of drinking water. The company that supplies Hertfordshire and North London now estimate they have between 10 to 15 years worth of supply left. Government announced quietly 2 weeks ago, we need to find another 5 billion litres of water a day within the next 20 years. That's a 35% increase in the raw resource. The same exploitation, the same lack of investment. The infrastructure doesn't exist. Hmm. There's no national network that we can divert water from Scotland to Southeast England.
Right. It rains a lot, but not that much.
And we now have a situation where 25 million people living in London, the Southeast of England, are now on the cusp of running out of water. So my advice to the new incoming government, you are going into managing the water industry, whether you like the idea or not.
Yep.
You simply cannot have the capital city of a G7 member state run out of drinking water in the next 10 to 15 years.
Right. And you've seen what's happened in cities like Cape Town, for example, where they did successfully as an entity manage their infrastructure better because they were forced to.
So,
and also in a case where there was terrible corruption and terrible mismanagement.
Sure. So when it comes to, do we have enough hydrologists, engineers, civil engineers, people who can project manage that kind of scale? 2 months ago, the chairman of the National Infrastructure Commission has now put a figure on it, and he estimates simply to secure London's water supply is now going to cost 60 billion quid in today's money.
Right.
I'll assume, like most big public spending projects in this country, by the time they get round to doing it, that will be 300 billion. And all of a sudden, you're now back to the Treasury and going, well, who's going to fund that?
Right.
So for me, it's the water thing is going to push the whole boulder down the hill, because then you have to confront it. You have to deal with it.
Right.
You can no longer.
Because no one can go a day without having a clean glass of drinking
water. That figure is dangerously close to the cumulative amount of dividends the privatised water companies have paid themselves since privatisation began.
It's clever, isn't it?
Fergal, I got a couple and I'll hand back to Richard, but just a couple on pragmatic solutions here. So the current reforms are tackling the question of earnings.
Yeah.
Previously, earnings by these privatised utilities equated to dividends to their shareholders. Fine. Now the proposal after the next 25 years, those earnings have to go into capital infrastructure to repair the system.
Yeah.
How do you think that's going to play out? I mean, is it just a case of these people have had a free ride for too long and we're calling in number 13, your time is up?
They simply have had a free ride for far too long, and the regulator, I've actually kind of, this is the weird thing, Will, I kind of have this strange empathy for the water companies.
What?
Because their job...
What side of bed did you get out of this morning?
Well, if somebody accused me the other day, for somebody who's fundamentally a socialist, I'm actually quite a bit of a capitalist. Because let's face it, their job was just to go and make as much bloody money as they could as quickly as possible.
And they did it. They did a great job.
And by God, they did a great job. And they were waiting for the regulator to kind of pop up and go, would you stop doing that, please? And the regulator never did. So guess what? They just kept going. So the truth is, there's two things now that we have to confront is the level and scale of investment, not only in the sewage system, but as we now know, London's water supply. So there's well over 100 billion quid as an opening gambit. And you now have the 60 billion pounds worth of debt sitting on balance sheets that they need to service.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is where the real battleground's going to lie, because we have to fix the infrastructure. That's just going to get done, because you cannot have 25 million people running out of water. The battleground is the bondholders, and it's back to that discussion. And I think we're all agreed, and anybody from a financial background I speak to, everybody's settled on it. The bondholders are just going to have to take a haircut. Yep. And that's the end of it.
They're going to get whacked.
Get over it.
Fergal, the way you illustrate this, I swear, as soon as this show goes live, I want to get to my friends at Netflix and get you to do a Wirecard biopic documentary like Dan McCrum did. It deserves it.
Starting out with you, you know, frowningly at your beautiful chalk stream, looking down at the river and wondering why it's so brown.
Yeah, that's not brown trout in there.
For those that want to do it, The Guardian ran an article written by a couple of very good friends of mine, Watershed Investigations, called Sewage Fungus and Everything You Don't Want to Know About It.
Oh.
So it'll give you a complete background. And here's the thing. Gowan has stand on the banks of pretty much any chalk stream in southern England right now, sewage fungus.
Right.
I.e., there's clearly unadulterated raw sewage going into those rivers.
Right.
Once you know what to look for, every single one of them carries the signs.
Oh, it's disgraceful. Fergal, it's a final question before handing you back to Richard here. It's an intergenerational one. And that is, the hunch in my head is perhaps consumers have had water too cheap for the past 20 plus years. So if I divided the population up into past, present and future consumers,
yeah,
and you know what's about to hit this industry,
yeah,
who's going to be the most pissed off and who's going to be the most sort of, well, I kind of had it good for a long while. I mean, these price increases with a spending squeeze, with inflation, with a mortgage time bomb, thank you Liz Truss, the only thing trickling down is a piss she's taking, is a famous quote for her. And with all of these things going on, we've got water prices going up. Break it down. How should past consumers feel? How should the present consumers feel? And how will future generations feel?
Well, let me remind you that when I started getting into this, I think I was heading towards my first meeting with the Treasury to discuss water companies. And as you know, well, when I go into those kind of meetings, I will spend quite a lot of time mentally working through every permeation.
Like a game of chess.
And every little kind of tributary that conversation might go, and I could not find a way to condense down the very thing you've just touched upon.
It's huge. Politically, it's huge.
And you, being the brilliant man that you are, I was in the middle of kind of giving you the background and my pitch, and you stopped me in the middle of that phone call going, Fergal, you're asking the wrong question. And I then invariably went, what's the question I need to ask? And you brilliantly came up with a very simple, concise idea. Do we have droughts in southern England because we run out of water or because water's too cheap? And we all know the answer to that.
Right.
And you go back to that political background in the background. And by the way, this is cross governments. There was this just placid acceptance, a nod and a wink, that we needed to artificially suppress the price of water because no political government wanted to take the hit and be blamed for another form of indirect taxation. So that's clearly played
it's
a massive part.
It's not indirect taxation, though. It's ensuring we don't have shit in our rivers.
Oh, no, but the political response to it would be, oh, no, the voters will see it as another form of indirect taxation. Water's false from the sky. We live in the United Kingdom, for God's sake. But it should be free.
In a society that we broadly accept this sort of mantra of capitalistic behavior, can we just settle on what the right rate of return should be, as opposed to having these supernatural 18 or 20% interest rates, the kind of stuff that drew USS for a second go at moths to the flame?
Yep.
And is there a way to flip it on its head and say, well, gradually, as a Thames Water bill payer, I should be part of a national savings plan where I'm gradually investing in the infrastructure and getting a stake in the equity.
So let me try it this way, Rondan, and this is just a random thing off the top of my head, and it's a range of possibilities here. Because, by the way, I could nationalise these companies tomorrow without costing the taxpayer a penny. Off the top of my head, simply amend the audit regulations, force them to declare the cost of fixing this as a liability on their balance sheets.
Yep.
Bingo, every one of them just failed the ongoing concern test. I've now just nationalised you because the law does not allow you to go into voluntary liquidation.
Right.
So I've just now taken control and it hasn't cost me a penny.
Going back in history, my example of Network Rail, where you had to pay off the shareholders. You wouldn't have to do that in this situation.
Absolutely not.
Right.
And as the Supreme Court ruled last year over the Northern Rock thing, the value of a company, share value of a company that's bankrupt is nothing. So there's all kinds of ways I can take control of them. The issue for me,
Richard, this is the power of this conversation.
Yeah.
Because once you expose it, the game of chess switches in the hand of the government's favour.
Oh, totally. So the issue,
now I'm beginning to understand the true depth of what you've been doing all this time,
Fergal. The issue is whether or not how you approach the current bondholders.
Yes.
Now, as you get the idea, I'm quite clearly of a disposition. These are grown-up professionals that knew what they were doing, that knew the risks involved. They were happy to take
the
cash.
There's always default risk.
Bingo. So you know what?
Credit, you're taking it back. That's why there's a giant $1 trillion of credit default swaps markets.
Then people will go, oh no, but then nobody won't invest because all the original bondholders have had to take a hit. Well, let me try it this way around. If I now, for example, turn Thames Water into a mutual.
Yes.
And I give the mutual the power to go and raise its own financing in the markets.
Right.
And go, well, but who wants to lend to this mutual when we've just killed off £16 billion worth of debt? Well, guess what? The mutual can now declare a debt guaranteed by the British government, 50-year bond, 4%, underwritten by the British government. And who wouldn't want a piece of that?
Well, you could also go to the ratepayers and say,
of course you can.
You know what? We'd like to have a sinking fund.
Correct.
You're going to pay a portion for your bill and a portion for your infrastructure. And
absolutely,
that infrastructure is like getting any of your other utilities to be also providing an insurance on the fact that they'll be continuing to provide quality service.
So for me, the simple reality is, will there be a water industry in 2 years' time? Yes, there will. Might it look very different from the one that currently exists? It probably will.
Right.
And by the way, why do we actually care in the UK? And I'm going to get very jingoistic. Bearing in mind that 70% of English water companies are actually in foreign ownership, including a long list of Southern Wind funds. What do we care what the Chinese government thinks?
Right. Well, you do need that constant flow of capital coming in and out of the country.
Done.
But
there's plenty of ways to organise that one.
Indeed.
And who does not want a piece of supplying water as a monopoly to 15 million people in the greater London area? Or as a nation, the 65 million people that live in England.
So let's move on to smoke signals, because I think we're now coming to the point where I think you've made it clear there's a tipping point coming with these companies.
Oh, yeah.
Many of them are unsustainable. You see where Kemble bonds are trading right now. They're pennies on the dollar.
Yep.
The market has already effectively written them off.
No, gone.
They're gone. And now we are moving through the layers, cave, or whatever you want to call it. The layers of debt are going to get knocked down. Yeah. And then there's going to be some intransigence on some parts of some bondholders that are going to want to be litigious about it.
Absolutely.
But let us know the couple of things to look out for, those staging posts where you say, okay, we're going to break through.
The first one is going to come in the middle of June. That five-yearly cycle of negotiations.
Yep, that's going on right now.
And in the middle of June, Ofwat will issue its interim determinations, signalling to the water companies, you've made your submissions, you've made your arguments, we've gone over and scrutinised your business plans, and here's what we think is going to be a reasonable rate of return and will allow you to make the investment that you need to fix your sewage system and secure the water system and do all the things you have to
do. And raise our bills by 60%.
You see, there's the thing. Ofwat is the power and authority that can go, absolutely not. We're not giving you a penny to cover the cost of the debt
what you should have
that
done.
You got yourself into.
Right.
The consumer is not picking up a penny of that cost.
Right, so that 30% of Thames Water P&L that services debt, sorry.
That's your problem.
Your problem.
Oh, and by the way, the investment you're now claiming you have to make to fix the sewage system because of the public outcry.
Should have been made already.
We've already told you. We gave you all the funding you needed for 33 years to make that investment. So you've had that money. So now I've taken another 30% off it.
Now, you were asking in this case, and I'll only pause now on this first smoke signal, that Ofwat has grown the cojones, so to speak, to make that determination, where we have spent 33 years where Ofwat was effectively a nice little a domesticated poodle, little lap dog.
I think what Ofwat needs to be incredibly sensitive to, when they issue those interim determinations, that's going to be in June.
Right.
The final determination needs to be happened by the end of the year.
Right.
Because it's for the pricing cycle 25 to 30.
Wow.
In the middle of all of that six-month layoff, there is going to be a general election. And I have to tell you right now,
gotta happen.
I am utterly determined to ensure that Ofwat's pricing determination in the water industry are right at the top of that voting list. And when people go in to tick a box on the voting form, the one they're going to be looking at mentally is Ofwat and government's policy.
And do you think Ofwat themselves have the people at the top who are ready to do a 180 from the revolving door that they were all part of, the gentleman's club or general, you know, the general people's club they were all part of, that said, let's make it cozy.
Individually, the board of Ofwat, right? The board of Ofwat, there's six non-executive directors and a chair. They're appointed by government. So because it's a regulator in this country, they are the legal entity that is Ofwat.
Should you be on one of those
do
chairs?
Do they have the kahunas to stand up and do this right now? No, they don't.
Okay.
But I'm pretty certain it's a political pressure.
Fergal,
and I have already suggested...
If invited, would you join one of those chairs?
No. I've done that job in the past. As you know, I'm a former regulator, which is why I know so much about the inside of it. Right. But at this point in my life, I'm actually quite happy, Will. I began my career in the most extraordinary way imaginable. As you know, for decades of my life, I could walk down the street all over the world and random people would come up to me and want to talk to me about music. And about gigs they'd been to and records they'd heard and radio shows.
You told me you made it in Derry when people ran over the street to spit at you. That was when you knew you became a celebrity. They could be bothered to run over the street to spit at Fergal Sharkey.
Here's the weird thing. Over the last 3 or 4 years, I now have random people walking up to me wanting to talk to me about shite in rivers.
Yep.
Guess what? I want to go back to talking about music again as quickly as possible. So I don't want to be running the new super-duper regulator, whatever it's going to be. The truth is, the water is going to get reformed. It's got no way out of it. The regulators are going to be under massive political scrutiny because I intend to do everything I can. And I have actually even suggested where I can have conversations that if there is going to be a change of administration, they, even right now, those political parties might want to be gently signalling to the regulator, you do not make any moves on this until we're in office and we're in power, because I do not want to walk into my office as the new Secretary of State for DEFRA and have this steaming pile of manure sitting on my desk that you made the decision a week before I took office and took control.
Yep.
You're not going there.
Okay.
So it's a political issue and I'm going to keep it one.
And that's a brilliant first smoke signal that we think something is coming to a head. We're going to see it happen imminently.
Yep.
Because you've got this determination coming up. A second one we should look at maybe more broadly about this experience with privatization. These incredibly efficient, modern companies that and it galls me when the FT readers point out brilliant comments after these articles. They're often better than the articles. There's so many brilliant commenters in this FT pieces. But some of them point to, for example, the British Airport Authority as being inefficient. Now they're so much more efficient. And every time I go to the airport, I walk for miles through this awful shopping mall that I don't want to go to get terrible service with the worst, you know, literally where, you know, Terminal 2, Gate 38 onwards is where hope goes to die, you know, without a single power plug because they're too cheap to provide extra electricity. Just the sort of rank privatization and sort of profiteering that happens in these things. Do we need to back away from the efficiency? What do we learn? Or what's the smoke signal to watch out for when you hear people talk about this experience of more efficient private companies?
Well, clearly,
what do we need to watch out for?
Clearly here in England, and it was thanks to Margaret Thatcher and that whole kind of Chicago School of Economics, and just the state should not be involved in anything, give it all over to the private sector for all the reasons you've just listed. As it turns out, we're now sitting here 35 years later, going, well, you know what? BT's kind of okay. There is, in terms of broadband, but that's quite heavily regulated.
Don't look at the share price.
Oh, listen, absolutely. And to this day, there's nobody really going to step up and invest the scale of money needed to build a national comms network to directly take on, provide competition. So truth is, has this water industry privatisation worked? No. Has the energy market worked? Well, anybody in the UK right now has been trying to pay their energy and gas and electricity bill for the last 2 years will tell you the answer. That's massive bloody failure right there.
Yep.
And I have to say, Will, I have some experience recently of trains in this country. By God, is that service getting worse by the day.
And it's and on a European level, it is much more expensive.
Dreadful. Utterly dreadful. I came up from Cardiff a couple of days ago, and I swear to God, just that carriage. Now, this is the main line between two capital cities in the United Kingdom, and I'm actually beginning to think, my God, this train's going to derail.
The engineer's trick is, can a cup of coffee or tea, a full cup of coffee or tea, stay unspilled on the table on one of these trains?
So and it's the truth not the is, case. I think there is probably an incredibly good doctorate for some really bright young economist to sit and look at three or four of the privatisations here in England and then just do a recap 40 years later, and I'm not sure one of them will actually come out smelling of roses in any way, shape or form.
Yeah, and it's pity because it was such an ideological battleground. There was no way to encourage these clearly bureaucratic, inefficient public sector utilities to change their behavior.
Absolutely.
But the shock therapy ended up with where we are today, which is tens of billions of dollars short on infrastructure investment, partly because you had the steroid-fueled private equity model overlaid onto privatization.
I can give you a very simple...
As opposed to the shareholder SID, public ownership, the idea that if we were all, as individuals in the UK, still owning these companies, as opposed to them being owned by private equity, we might take a different view as stakeholders rather than
totally. I can
profiteers.
I can give you an example right now, if I remember this correctly, and I might not, so if I don't, send the angry emails to me.
No.
When Macquarie bought Thames Water, I have reason to believe, I have some kind of recollection, the regulator did actually write to Macquarie and make it clear to them, do not put the cost of this deal on the balance sheet.
Right.
Because we all know it's the bill payers are going to end up paying for the cost of that deal and not your shareholder, Macquarie shareholders. Well, that lasted about 2 years, and then Macquarie put the cost of the deal on Thames Water's balance sheet.
Right.
And just kept adding to it and adding to it and adding to it. And that's why, for me, I have more irony for the regulators and the utter failure of their obligations, their duties to protect the environment and the consumer and the bill payer.
Right.
And they've failed on every single count. I'll give you one last example. The Environment Agency, people will go, Liz Truss, when she was Secretary of State, cut their budget in 2015, absolutely killed the organisation. It's true. But I then sit there and go, but hang on, you were on the board. And if there's one job every single board of every organisation has to do every year, it's make sure that organisation has the resourcing, the financing, the funding, the systems and the people to go and do its job. So as the board member of the Environment Agency, don't blame the Secretary of State. Where were you?
Right.
And your conversations with the Treasury and Number 10 and the Cabinet Office.
Passing the
and
buck.
And what were you doing to do your job and safeguard that organisation and its legal obligations and the 10,500 people that work for you?
Right. And your attitude towards the vampire kangaroo is they can't help themselves. They're going to jump around
grab
some blood.
You can script it. There's nothing secret about it. And I quite admire the Macquaries of this world.
Yeah.
It does what it says on the packet.
Right. Make as much bloody money as we possibly can, as quickly as we can, and get out of Dodge City.
And if
we
can sell the carcass on to somebody else for another chunk
even
of
better.
Change, hurrah!
Fergal, if I bring this breathtaking episode of Bubble Trouble to a close, firstly, when you came onto our show last summer, I know that your appearance on Bubble Trouble helped you wind in your sails. I could feel that it was accelerating. Your performance at the FT Weekend Festival was phenomenal. I really hope this episode, this boomerang bounce back, does exactly the same, that we go faster and faster as time runs out.
It may be kind of, invariably you get into speaking to yourself in the third person, and it's always a slightly weird thing.
Sure.
What I've taken, and I think they probably think I'm being disruptive, but I'm really not.
I don't think you are.
I have explained this to people in Number 10.
I don't think
you
are at all.
People in government, people in Whitehall, and in the water industry. I lost control of this about a year ago. It's no longer my issue. It now belongs to the British public. I've lost control of it. Government's lost control of it. The industry's lost control of it. You're now in the hands of the British public, and by God, are they angry and unhappy with you.
Well, let me just explain for our international audience who might be thinking, what on earth has Britain done with its privatised utilities? Using three fingers on one hand, the axioms that led to this.
Yeah.
One, why is the private sector more efficient than the public sector? The axiom is that the private sector can go bust, therefore it's kept on its toes, therefore it performs more efficiency than the public sector. Two, then how on earth do you bring the private sector in to run public sector utilities, which can't go bust? Mm-hmm. The argument is there's a credible threat from the public sector to say, if you underperform, I'm bringing that back into public hands. finger three, the middle finger to all of this, figure three, is what happens if that credibility erodes over time?
Yeah.
And that in an A, B, C, 1, 2, and 3 is the problem. The credibility has been lost and the private sector has taken us to the cleaners. If I can finish on a lighter note, which was encouraging to hear you say you want to talk about music more or less, I think I've worked out what the solution is for you, Fergal.
What?
You're going to make the Gibb brothers a lot of money. You're going to do your own interpretation or interpolation of Kenny Rogers and Dolly Parton's Islands in the Stream.
And it's good night from him. It's good night from him. And it's good night from me.
Thank you so much, Fergal, for coming on Bubble Trouble.
Terrific.
Pleasure as always.
If you're new to Bubble Trouble, we hope you'll follow the show wherever you listen to podcasts. And please share it on your socials. Bubble Trouble is produced by Eric Newsom, Jesse Baker, and Julia Nett at Magnificent Noise. You can learn more at bubbletroublepodcast.com. Until next time, from my co-host Richard Kramer, I'm Will Page.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.